KALW.
I remember answering the phone, and all of a sudden this voice said, "Hi there, this is Jim Henson." And I went like, "Hada, hada, hawa."
Muppet performer Dave Goals tells us what it was like to work in the creative world of the late Jim Henson.
Everybody that Jim hired was different. Like, we didn't feel like we were home when we got there. We thought, we're in a zoo.
We'll hear about a San Francisco exhibit that honors the late creator's colorful journey into children's television. Then three local authors read from their memoirs, Rachel Michaelberg, Melissa Harris, and Kristen Keene.
It's about my caregiving journey following my husband's severe traumatic brain injury.
My book is about having my second child when I was just 24 weeks pregnant.
It explores the concept of death and time travel.
Books and Muppets. That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Jim Henson's creativity and magic has been entertaining children for decades. We grew up on shows like Sesame Street, The Muppet Show, Fraggle Rock, and those shows continue to delight young audiences today. The Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco is honoring the late puppeteer with the Jim Henson exhibition, Imagination Unlimited. Dave Goals began working with Jim Henson back in the 70s on The Muppet Show. He was the puppeteer for that blue, big-nosed, furry favorite, Gonzo. And he became fascinated with Sesame Street while creating scientific instruments in Silicon Valley. He still is a puppeteer for Jim Henson projects, and KALW's Janae Darden spoke with him.
Dave, I am thrilled that you are here.
Thank you very much, Janae. Pleasure to be here.
I told you before, I grew up as a huge Muppet fan. I had Miss Piggy raincoat, Miss Piggy umbrella. I went to Muppets on Ice, Sesame Street on Ice, so I'm a serious Muppets fan. And so I'm really excited to talk to you for that reason. So before you started becoming a Muppet performer, you were working in Silicon Valley, and you were obsessed with Sesame Street. Now, you were an adult, so I know why I was obsessed with Sesame Street. What was it about Sesame Street that motivated you to even become a Muppet performer? What was it about that show?
It was the Muppets. I was fascinated. I started watching when I was 25, I think. And I just happened to catch it by accident and was just fascinated by the characters. I just thought Ernie and Bert were genius. They were a beautiful comedy team. They looked like who they were. They moved like who they were. And they spoke like who they were. And they wore clothes that each character would have bought. So I looked at it as a designer. You know, I was an industrial designer in Silicon Valley. And I looked at it and thought, this has got to be a whole bunch of people who are on the same page. You know, somebody made those costumes. Somebody made the puppets. Somebody wrote the material. Somebody directed it. Somebody performed it. And I just got intensely curious about how they organized all that, you know?
What was Jim Henson doing that others weren't, who were doing puppeteering or even like child entertainment?
Well, I certainly wasn't watching children's entertainment at the time because I was, whatever I was, 25 and just, you know, a single guy. But what he was doing that I liked, and maybe others were doing it, maybe they weren't, was that he was working on multi-levels. He was working on an adult level and a children's level at the same time. And there was also, you know, there was a lot of stuff, a lot of humor in Sesame Street in those days that was for adults, you know. It wasn't risque, but it was just the kind of cultural references that adults would pick up on. You know, a parent watching the show would laugh at one thing, their child would laugh at something else, and it all coexisted beautifully.
I know sometimes puppeteers, their personality comes out in their puppets. How does Gonzo reflect you, or did he reflect you?
Well, I was completely untrained when I joined the Muppets. I had never had an acting class. I had no idea what I was doing. I had an aptitude for working puppets. And I was thrown into an international variety show, like right cold. And so I was really insecure. Every week we had a different famous guest, you know?
Yes.
And we had a rehearsal hall with two doors. It was, I'd see Sylvester Stallone or Danny Kaye or Bob Hope walk in one of the doors each week. And I would walk out the other one. I thought, I don't belong here. This is not my place. I'm supposed to be at home on the couch watching the TV. And it took years before I felt comfortable being there. So anyway, that alienation and that insecurity came through in the original Gonzo. Mm-hmm. You know, he was convinced he had something, but the audience seemed to be cretins. They didn't understand what he was doing. They didn't understand his art.
Thank you. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, I will eat this rubber tire to the music of the Flight of the Bumblebee. Maestro. Yokos! What do they know about art?
And so I sort of couldn't help playing him from an insecure place, you know. Then after I got a little better at it, a couple of years later, we got into the bombastic phase where he just thought everything was cool and he was excited and did wild, crazy things and had very high energy.
Yes.
And so that counteracted the first phase, but didn't eliminate it. So I could still be insecure, you know, but it broadened his character.
Putting on my top hat, tying up my white tie, dusting off my
Wait, he's trying to get to the oatmeal.
Don't worry. We got spoons and milk and brown sugar.
Yeah, we're going to eat our way through to him.
And then the final phase was when we did Muppet Christmas Carol and Gonzo had to play the part of Charles Dickens and read that incredible narration. And those scenes were something that I really welcomed because by that time I had grown enough that I loved the chance to say things that came from wisdom with that character.
But the thing that made Scrooge happiest of all was that his life lay before him, and it could be changed.
I will live my life in the past, the present, and the future of Jacob and Robert.
What was it like when you met Jim Henson? I mean, were you like, did you kind of, were you look speechless like me?
Well, that's a great question, Janae. First of all, Jim was the nicest guy. He would make anybody feel at ease. So when I met him personally, I was comfortable. The first time I spoke to him, though, was I was sitting at Hewlett-Packard at my desk in Silicon Valley, and he called up to invite me down to L.A. because he had heard that I made good puppets and you should meet me. And I remember answering the phone, and all of a sudden this voice said, "Hi there, this is Jim Henson." And I went like, "Hada, hada, hawa." I didn't say it out loud, but I stood up and I worked in a lab that was about an acre big and there were partitions up to your chest everywhere. And I looked all around the lab and I thought, I'm talking to Jim Henson here. Jim Henson just called on the phone and I'm the only one talking to him in here. And then I realized, oh, Jim's on the phone. I better answer, you know, so went back to the conversation. But once I met him in person, I was completely comfortable. And then, you know, one of the things about all of this was I was satisfied at every stage of getting involved. Like when I met Frank Oz at that puppetry festival in Oakland. And I just thought, wow, I met Frank Oz. This is great. I'll be able to tell my grandchildren about this. It's fantastic. That's enough for me. And then I went to New York and I met all the Muppet people and got to hang out at Sesame Street. And I thought the same thing. I thought, wow, I got to see that. I actually had a week to visit and they were nice people and I met everybody. And then when I met Jim, we met in a rehearsal room at CBS Television City. And he was there to do a Perry Como show. And I had three of my puppets that I had by now built. Mm-hmm. And he picked up one and started ad-libbing and I picked up another and started ad-libbing. And I was internally thinking, I am performing with Jim Henson. This is the best thing ever. I'll never forget this. This is the best. I didn't know it would go beyond that. And that night, I went back to see them shoot the Perry Como special. And I sat in an empty audience with Jane Henson. And she said, "So are you going to be working with us?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know. We didn't really talk about that." And she said, "I'm sure Jim will find something for you to do." I was just absolutely, I had no idea how prescient that was because I'm still doing it. It's like,
it's
49 years later. And actually, it's a good time to mention for your audience that this exhibition is just lovely. It's the most beautiful thing to see a man's journey, a Pied Piper at work, pulling more and more people in as he could afford to do it. And the effects of collaboration between people who were unlike each other.
Yeah.
You know, everybody that Jim hired was different. Like, we didn't feel like we were home when we got there. We thought we were in a zoo. Like, they're all different than each other. And of course, through this, I learned in life that diversity is just the best thing ever.
And this exhibit, this exhibition, it has, if you're a fan of Jim Henson, you'll love it. You see Sesame Street, you see The Muppet Show, you see Labyrinth, you see, you know, all these shows, but Muppet Babies. But one show that I have to talk about that I remember when it came out, and people were, even when I was in school, the big kids loved this show, is Fraggle Rock.
Mm.
Fraggle Rock, that's one of the best theme songs to a show. And your puppet was Boober, and he's pessimistic, anxious. Fun for him is like doing laundry and cooking. Where did the idea come from?
I was very good friends with Jerry Jewell, our head writer. I was on a plane with Jerry Jewell once, and I was stressing because, you know, we were living a complicated life. I had a home in Northern California, but I worked in England half the year. And then the other half of the year, we might do a movie somewhere else. And I could hardly ever get home to get the house painted, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a very stressful, you know, life. And I said something to Jerry about, I don't know, life is just death and laundry. And he picked up on that. He thought that was a funny combination, you know, to base a philosophy on. And when they wrote Fraggle Rock, I looked at the character descriptions and I thought, they made Boober for me.
Please, please, it's got to be now. If I don't get the rock soap, then I won't be able to finish the laundry. And if I don't finish the laundry, there'll be odors. Yuck.
I don't know if people realize how physical this is.
Cool.
When I walked through the exhibit and I was looking at how you all have your hands up, and because I always kind of wondered how did that work. And when I've seen, you know, behind the scenes films about the work that you all do, it's very physical. You've been injured. You've had surgeries.
I've had 9 puppetry related surgeries.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, it's taken its toll orthopedically. It's hard. You get, you know, the blood comes out of your hand. You know, we can do about 5 minutes before we need to come down. But there have been times when we've done live shows where we did a 13-minute musical montage. And for that, we had special rigs built by our workshop that held our arms up. But most of the time, we don't use that rig because it does limit your movement.
You've been doing this for 50 years. You've entertained generations and generations of young adults, of children, of those of us who are children at heart. What do you want your legacy to be as it relates to the work that you've done?
Oh, well, you know, we're not really known by the public at large. You know, most people have no idea who does these characters. They just like the characters. And I'm fine with that. I don't really want the attention, you know.
Mm-hmm.
After we get off, I want to go to Lowe's and buy some cup hooks, you know. It's nice to have anonymity, and I treasure it. But legacy, I guess the body of work, you know, I think it's, to some degree, some of it is timeless. You know, it has certain temporal references, like The Muppet Show was, our guests were the stars of that era. But on the other hand, we did music from all genres, from classical to whatever the latest thing was, to blues, to pop. You know, we've literally, and to the present time, we've worked in hip hop. We've worked in all kinds of genres. So those things, I think, have longer legs, you know, those will last longer.
That was Muppet performer Dave Gohl speaking with KLW's Janae Darden. That interview was co-produced by Porfirio Rangel. The Jim Henson exhibition is running at the Contemporary Jewish Museum through August 14th.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows? And what's on the other side? Rainbows are visions, but only illusions. And rainbows have nothing to hide.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. Next, we'll hear from some Bay Area writers. In this episode of New Arrivals, three authors read from their new memoirs.
This is New Arrivals, a pocket-sized book tour with Bay Area authors. I'm Lisa Morehouse. Today, we'll hear three local writers read from their memoirs, all of which chronicle loss. The first is about the moral dilemmas inherent in caring for sick or disabled loved ones. Rachel Michaelberg lives in Los Altos Hills. Her book, Crash, How I Became a Reluctant Caregiver, came out in April 2021.
It's about my caregiving journey following my husband's severe traumatic brain injury that he sustained in a plane crash. Here's a key passage. It's the day after the accident and my first time seeing him after facial reconstruction surgery. I make my way to the bedside tentatively. I'm afraid to touch him. He's barely recognizable. So much swelling. So many tubes. I stroke his hand, trying to avoid the oxygen monitor on his index finger. David's skin is dry, papery. I should bring some of that nice lavender hand cream from home. Wait, he doesn't care. Hell, he may not even wake up. Oh, David, I sigh, forcing myself to really study him. Please don't die. I say these words dutifully. But somewhere in the most shameful, monstrous depths of my being, I know I don't fully mean them.
That was Rachel Michaelberg reading from Crash. Our next reading also takes place bedside at a hospital. Oakland's Melissa Harris wrote 1 pound, 12 ounces, which came out in November 2021.
My book is about my struggles with secondary infertility, miscarriage, and ultimately having my second child when I was just 24 weeks pregnant. From there, I take the reader along with me during the 95 days my son was in the hospital through his first birthday. Here is a passage. As Dr. Wharton finished sewing me up, the OR was pretty quiet until the phone rang. It was the NICU nurse calling to give me the basic stats on Sam. He was 12 inches long and weighed 1 pound 12 ounces. Dr. Wharton stopped mid-stitch. "Can you repeat that?" he asked the OR nurse who had answered the phone. They said the baby was 12 inches long and weighed 1 pound 12 ounces, she repeated. "Really? 1 pound 12 ounces? Wow. 1 pound 12 ounces. That's huge. Great," Dr. Wharton said to no one. He kept mumbling things like, "That's so big," and "That's so great," the rest of the time I was on the operating table. I had a hard time wrapping my head around the idea that a 1 pound 12 ounce baby was large, but Dr. Wharton's enthusiasm was contagious.
That was Melissa Harris reading from 1 pound, 12 ounces. And finally, we move from motherhood to losing a mother. Author Kristen Keene lives in San Francisco. Her book, An Encyclopedia of Bending Time, came out April 12, 2022.
An Encyclopedia of Bending Time is about losing my mother. Written as an encyclopedia of our lives together, it explores the concept of death and time travel and puts thinkers like Einstein into conversation with pop cultural artifacts like the TV show Quantum Leap. Here is one of the key passages in the book. This is a story that is told in reverse, about reversal, about making, about unmaking. It starts at one kind of ending, then moves backwards. This story is a corpus held together by strings of love, by themes, by memories. Surely it is missing parts. No, this is not in reverse. It is flipped upside down. The beginning of the story was told in order. Now it is focused on the experience of time and life without you. You were here on a Friday when you went to the hospital. You were here the following week when we took you home. By Monday, you were gone. The next day, I learned someone had taken my name, the mystery Kristen Keene. The order of events matters less now than the feeling of them, a then-time memory emerging after a between. I am sorry if the way I'm constructing the story causes you to lose your bearings. I'm just not sure, actually, where things end or begin.
That was Kristen Keene reading from An Encyclopedia of Bending Time.
New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse. You can hear more Bay Area authors reading from their books at klw.org/newarrivals. And before we leave you, let's listen to some new music from a local band. This is San Francisco's electronic dance duo, Top Secret Robot Alliance. They'll be playing in the city this Friday at Bottom of the Hill.
Never heard a song, not about dancing. Never wrote a beat, not about dancing. Never danced a dance, not about dancing. That's why I choose dance. And when I wake each morning, I think about dancing. And when I go to work, I think about dancing. And when it's time to sleep, I go out dancing. That's why I choose dance. They choose money, we choose dance. They choose friends, we choose dance. They choose talent, we choose dance. Choose dance, choose dance.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Hanisha Harjani, Lucen Mendel, Raphael Cohen, James Rollins, Gabe Graben, Victor Tense, Shirin Adil, Shaya Levitt, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hena Baba.
When I'm feeling joy, I go out dancing. And when I'm feeling